Love is a driving factor in our decisions. People plan their lives around who they love. They stay close to their parents, take a completely random job to stay with their spouse, and save hundreds of thousands of dollars for their future children's education. But just as the people we love drive our decisions, so do what activities we love. Paul Gauguin, a famous French Impressionist painter, ran away from his wife and children, culture and country, to pursue his love of painting in Tahiti. The composer Peter Tchaikovsky gave up a potentially lucrative career as a civil servant to study composition with no previous experience, just for his love of music. Less dramatically, however, we make these decisions all the time in our lives. We sacrifice our times to read, our bodies to play sports, or our sleep to go watch Taylor Swift concerts. We do these activities because we love them. And this love, many philosophers argue, gives our life meaning. But do all activities, even ones that are trivial, but that we might enjoy, contribute to meaning? Can humans love any task at all? If not, what is the criterion and who makes it? And why should we care? Join us today as we unpack the paradox between meaning and love.
All right, everybody, welcome to Open Door Philosophy. I am Derek Parsons, and along with me is Andrew Graziano.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
And Taylor Jones.
Hello, everybody.
And welcome to episode 63, our second episode on love. This time we're discussing Andrew's views specifically on love, and we can't wait. But first of all, guys, it's so hot. Anyway, how are you doing?
It is so hot. Well into the triple digits.
It really is. This is kind of probably surprising to people who've seen me, but I actually kind of enjoy doing like mechanical work on cars and stuff. And so I've been working on this family car. It's not like a fancy car. It's just like our family car. And it's been so hot that, are y'all familiar with what a dipstick is for the oil?
Mm-hmm. I'm quite familiar, yes.
Yeah. The top of it melted off, like the
oh
little...
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, because it's so hot. And the windshield nozzle that sends the fluid to, you know, to the car, that also melted. So some good old American manufacturing, which is usually pretty good, but it's just been, I guess it's not prepared for this heat. It is ridiculous.
This car you're working on, is it made of wax by chance?
It's made of chocolate.
Very good. No, seriously, what kind of car is it?
It's a Ford. It's usually great cars, and it's like, you know, but I don't know.
Wait, a Ford what? Year? Model?
I can't give away that much information. People are going to start, you know, hounding me on the road.
Too personal. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, Andrew's working on a car. Taylor, how are you?
I'm good. I have officially started preparing for school.
Mm.
Only 1 month out.
Yeah, that's kind
of... I know. Nobody's surprised if you know me. But I just crafted the most beautiful Notion page anyone has ever seen. And it took me like 5 hours. And then I made a spreadsheet for all the things that I need to pack to bring to school. And that's about it.
I do not doubt any of those things you just said.
Really?
No. It's all color-coded, too.
Of course it's color-coded.
Of course.
Oh, Taylor, you know, one of these days I'm going to hire you just to organize my life.
I love organizing. It makes me feel so at peace when everything is organized.
Man, this is like a new level, a new type of meditation, Andrew. We should try this.
It really is so meditative.
No, I'm not joking.
Everything
like,
I have is
okay, I'm kind of joking, but like, yeah, legit, I can see it.
Also, Andrew, you included a second Taylor Swift reference in your intro. Well, you referenced the concert, and then you snuck in this love right after that.
Yeah, so actually, this is really funny. So I've been doing like these in-teacher service trainings today. And so we were meeting with the English department, and guess what we did? We analyzed Taylor Swift's Anti-Hero.
No. Why do English teachers do this?
I don't know.
Not just Taylor Swift, but any...
No.
Let's analyze these rap lyrics.
Here's the thing. I was pleasantly surprised with a total of 3 lines, and I thought the rest were pretty bad.
What lines did you like?
Andrew, we gotta know.
Yeah. Everybody's on their seat.
I am.
Me too.
Although in Taylor Swift's singing, I'm standing up, but you know.
Of course.
That's a dad joke.
It's something about leaving. Like, I thought this was super sad. I thought these lines were super sad. I wake up screaming from dreaming. One day I'll watch as you're leaving because you got tired of my scheming.
Oh, yeah. For the last time.
I can't even do it with a straight face reading it out loud.
I'm the problem. It's
like kind of clever when you read it, but then when you say it, it's not clever anymore.
Well, you know, it rhymes. So if you're not singing it, it feels kind of weird, like you're doing a 19th century British poetry or something. Yeah, no, that's a great, great line.
That's true.
I really like the beginning of the second verse, where she talks about how she's a monster on the hill.
Yeah, somebody was saying that was a Beowulf reference, but I don't believe that.
That's English teachers just trying too hard.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, I think that's either English teachers trying too hard, or she's like super into old English literature for some reason, or she has a ghostwriter.
I think it's just English teacher trying too hard.
Yeah, that's trying too hard. I mean, don't we all feel like monsters on the hill every now and then? So let's get to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's me. Hi. I'm Mr. Parsons, and I am, frankly, I'll be honest, Andrew, I was actually kind of moved that you included Taylor Swift in your intro.
I did that for y'all.
I know you did. I know you did. Yeah. It might be a sign of love, but we'll get to that later in the episode. I'm fine. I'm working again, and I have, over the last 3 days, endured about 14 hours of meetings in 3 days, which has been fantastic. I say that ironically. Anyway, I do have a new office and I finally hung things on the wall. So I feel like I've accomplished things this week. Also, it's so hot that right now the thermostat in my house is set at 75, but it says it's 79 in the house. So our AC can't even keep up with the heat. So anyway, I have been watering our yard like crazy. Well, not like crazy because I don't want to waste water. But also, I'm just trying to make sure the grass doesn't become crunchy. Yeah. So that's my life right now. And it's great. I am actually getting really excited about teaching some philosophy soon. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Very exciting. It's sad that you have a different office now. Because
you guys totally need to come by. Like if you're ever like...
I want to.
Just standing here, you're like sitting around the house. You're like, I'm so bored. Oh,
I have literally nothing to do.
I should text Parsons and see if he's available. Come see his office. I would love for you guys to see my office.
Field trip.
Last week, we discussed some introductory terms around love and how different philosophers across the ages conceived of love and how it developed over time. We covered 6 philosophers: Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, Nozick, Frankfurt, rest in peace, and Wolf. One of our main goals in doing so was to show similarities and differences across the ages of this literature on love. And I think that one of the similarities that we saw way back from Plato was that love is a motivating factor in people's lives for the lovers themselves. Back in Plato's Symposium, we saw that Alcibiades, at the very end of it, makes a speech taunting Socrates just because he's in love with him. In Aristotle, we see that people are drawn to loving friendships. And so it's just a very common factor. But I think that in modern conceptions of love, we think of love more as an emotion, right? As something that's more of a not motivating, or maybe not motivating on the forefront, but I think at least it's interesting that these philosophers, I mean, in their first ideas, when they were laying out what love is, they identified it primarily as a motivating factor, where we don't recognize that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think partially for that is because of some of the Enlightenment thinkers, which you can kind of note that we skipped conveniently over them.
We did.
Yeah. And so this idea of love as a motivating factor was picked up again in the 20th century, by some of these philosophers who were interested in emotion and in virtue and trying to get outside of the analytical tradition, who were actually inside of it, but that's fine. Last week's episode, we ended with Susan Wolf's theory of what love was or what it encompassed. And do you want to explain this since you did it, or do you want me to go for it?
Oh, geez, please go ahead. I would only do a very poor job.
Let me pull up my quote real quick.
I mean, Wolf, I've got your paper right here. An agent does not undertake a meaningful activity because they see it as potentially meaningful. Instead, love acts as a motivation for undertaking an activity and continuing it.
Yeah, well, let's just start there. Susan Wolf really, I mean, her entire book, that's really actually quite famous. One of her best stuff, and we can talk about why I think that's interesting in a second, is framed around love as a motivating factor. So I have a question for y'all before you jump into it.
Mm-hmm.
When y'all think about love, before we talked about this, did you think of love as a motivating factor? Or like, what was your kind of impressions or thoughts around it? Or did you even really think about it at all?
Mr. Parsons, do you want to go first?
Let's see. I'll just riff here. So one of my questions I always have with love is like, where does it come from? And I find love to be an incredibly mysterious force, which is kind of a funny word to use for that. But nonetheless, it has to come from somewhere, because if you believe in the law of causation, everything comes from something else. And so you would think that something must encourage love or motivate love. The great mystery is like, well, what exactly is that? If we're talking about romantic love, why is that one special person the person? If we're talking about love for a sports team, or love for our country, or love for our friends, you know, there has to be something that motivates that, to use Wolf's languaging. I'm just very curious what that is for all those very many different scenarios. Does it come down to biology? Is there some type of subconscious preference there? I don't know. Those are my off the top of my head.
Great. What do you think, Taylor?
I don't think that I'd given it much thought before, of love as a motivation. But now that I do, from my experience, it seems like love is one of our core motivations, that whether it's searching for romantic love or platonic love in our friends or strengthening familial relationships, even down to how people practice the Christian faith, searching for the love of God, that love is everywhere in our lives and we can't really escape that. And I think because of that, it serves as such a motivation that we see love everywhere and want to pursue love and magnify how much love there is in the world.
Yeah, great. And I think, just like to wrap up all of y'all's, I had never really thought about love before. I read this, one of her original papers, and then I got to this. And it's kind of funny that I didn't think of it, because, I mean, I think that I experience probably love on a daily, or hopefully daily, occurrence from parents and close friends and grandparents and whatever. And so love is like kind of a, at least it's probably not for everyone, but it was a pretty consistent force in my life, I think. It was really, like, really important to me in my relationships. So it's kind of funny that something so important to me was something that I overlooked, even as someone interested in philosophy, where we're supposed to look at these underpinnings of our life. Wolf comes at love from a side angle. And what I mean by that is she's looking at what love is based upon what motivates us to live, what gives us meaning in life. And so I think you just read this. She says, and this is the view that she presents called the fitting fulfillment view of meaning, which is not that important for us, but it's important for our understanding of love. A life is meaningful insofar as its subjective attractions are to things or goals that are objectively worthwhile. So we see two parts here. The first is that we have subjective attractions, and those subjective attractions are to activities that are worthwhile objectively. So if we were making like a math equation, it would be subjective attraction plus objectively worthwhile activities equals meaning. The reason how love is incorporated into this is on this first subjective attractions part. For us to be subjectively attracted to something, we have to love that. It's something that we love. And so it's like an activity or something that relates from an activity. And so her second part of that is this objectively worthwhile part, where it's possible for us to love that we're subjectively attracted to, but that has no objective worth. And so the example that she uses is this guy, Sisyphus, who is popular from Greek mythology, who rolls a ball up a hill, and then it falls down, and he has to re-push it back up for all of eternity. And her point is, like, say that Taylor, somehow is transported to the depths of Hades. And for fun, she did this. And she just sat on the beach watching Sisyphus push this ball up forever. And she got great pleasure out of it. She thought it was hilarious. That activity, even though she loved it, was not objectively worthwhile for her. There's a few more examples that she uses. And so the point is there that love can exist to things that are objectively unworthwhile. We're getting a view of love there. And one, that view of love is based on what activities we can do and enjoy. So Taylor can fall in love with knitting. She can fall in love with, I don't know, what's something else you like? Reading philosophy, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else. Organizing, doing Notion. You know, you can fall in love with all of these activities, even if they're not worthy of you loving them. Does this make sense? This is a very important point.
Yeah. Can I stop you there, though?
Yeah.
So I'm interested in the subjective versus objective. So there must be something that person is motivated, if I'm using the right language here, motivated to love something, but that's subjective. But yes. The thing that the object that is the attention of the love must be objectively worthwhile. So in your example, Taylor in the depths of Hades, by the way, Taylor, if you ended up there, I would totally come to visit. I'd bring you some tea or something. Like, we'd have a nice time.
Sorry, Taylor. That was kind of throwing you under the bus. But given Taylor chooses this,
she chooses this.
She, like, has a portal and goes and visits.
I'm just going to start calling Taylor Persephone. But anyway.
Okay.
I'll bring a picnic basket. It'll be lovely.
Okay.
But so Taylor enjoying watching Sisyphus struggle, pushing this ball, or a boulder, rather, up the hill. Her enjoyment of that is subjective, but the object, which is Sisyphus pushing this boulder up the hill, that is objective. In other words, that's not something worthy of Taylor's love, even though Taylor loves watching it happen. Am I explaining that right?
Yep, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I think an immediate question that jumps out is like, why is this task objectively like not worthy, right? Like this is what I would immediately think of. And Wolf is kind of vague here. Her point is that these activities, they don't really involve anyone else other than ourselves. These very trivial activities, they don't connect us to a community larger than ourselves. She's quoted as saying, these activities do not depend on one's own contingent interest in them. So Taylor has no stake. She's doing it by herself. She's not helping anyone. There's no one she's doing the activity with. Yeah, it's rather trivial. Another example might be going in the forest, picking up a leaf, and then dropping it, and then finding another one, picking up and dropping it. It's like these really mundane tasks. or counting, like literally going to the beach and counting grains of sand. And so the point is not to be like arbitrary here. It's to show that some activities are just not worthy of us doing them, right? So she's just showing that these activities exist. So that's the point. It's not to be mundane. It's not to be arbitrary. She's just showing that there are activities that exist in the world that are not worth us doing and that are really not worth us loving. But we can love them. What she's saying is that like there are tasks in this world that we love that are actually objectively worthwhile for us to do, like crocheting, like playing the violin, like writing philosophy papers. Because for whatever reason, and, you know, they connect us to a larger community, we make gifts for people with our crocheting necks. They challenge us intellectually. You know, we can perform for our family and friends.
Still waiting for that Taylor Swift cardigan, by the way. Yeah, if we're making gifts.
I'll add it to the list. That'll take a while, though.
But maybe I can make a Taylor Swift reference here. It's like, if we are a fully formed cognitive adult, there's a lot of things that we probably shouldn't get joy out of and that just objectively wouldn't add meaning to our life. Let's just imagine, for example, someone just loves doing these mundane activities, right? Like this is a possible example, like counting grains of sand, getting the entire Taylor Swift corpus, writing them by hand and then burning them. No one's ever going to see them. The point is like, yeah, these just like are kind of dumb tasks. They're not going to add any meaning to our lives. Therefore, there's no love that exists in them. Here's where I come in, I think. And I have kind of two...
Oh, well, can I stop you? I'm so sorry.
No, please.
Can I stop you before we get to that?
Please.
So I just want to criticize Wolf a bit before I'm sure you do the same thing. I'm thinking of these activities that specifically that you mentioned, tailor knitting. So my question with the whole objective aspect of this argument is, well, who says, right? Who says that knitting is more meaningful than someone counting grains of sand on the beach? What am I trying to say? I don't understand who or what the arbitrator is of what is objectively meaningful. Of course, we can think of all kinds of examples of people doing things that we don't think is very meaningful to us, but to them very well may be. For instance, a week or an episode or two ago, Andrew, you mentioned you enjoy watching the Netflix show Suits, which is, as and I think I'm quoting you here, complete garbage is what you said it was. Now, perhaps this show Suits adds meaning to your life. Maybe it doesn't. But the thing I want to tie into this is the idea of leisure. So you're kind of saying that, or rather Wolf is saying that, in order for something to be worthy of love, it must create a type of meaning, an important objective meaning. And the idea of leisure, and I think this is very important in American culture, the idea of just doing nothing is usually kind of frowned upon. You can think of things, typical criticism of parents with teenagers, perhaps playing video games. Those don't really add any meaning to your life. But it is leisurely and it is enjoyable. You can also think of perhaps a person who has gone on a trip to the Bahamas. Well, they're just sitting on the beach. They're not doing much. Maybe they're reading a book. It's probably a fluff book. And, you know, Cabana Boy brings them a pina colada every hour. And they're just like, this doesn't add anything meaningful to their life. Leisure is just something that is a waste of time unless it's something important. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was growing up with my kids, or rather when my kids were growing up with me, you know, there was this movement in video games for it to be important. You know, like this video game must result in some sort of acquisition of knowledge. For instance, educational type games, rather than just a game for fun. So with this whole objective and meaning and how that relates to love, I find that interesting. Because what is the measure here? And can something be leisurely, if you will? In other words, can something be without a great deal of meaning or result in any sort of meaningful result? Why can't that be love? I mean, am I even phrasing that right? I don't know. Does my long ramble make any sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Let me pretend to be Wolf for a second.
Okay.
She would say, yeah, something like leisure. Sure, that's fine. That might make you feel better, like might improve your mental health. Sure. That's like might be a worthwhile thing for you to do, but it's not going to add meaning to your life. So I think there's a high bar for a meaningful project. Like for something to actually add meaning, to give you like a reason to live, it's like needs to be something that's going to engage you in some way. So it's like, yeah, leisure is important, like getting your nice tan and sipping the piña colada and doing nothing. Yeah, that's great. But it's probably not meaningful. But I think that's a really great point, because I think that it's often thought that, and this is something that she argues against, and so I'm so glad you brought it up. She is a reaction against this idea. In philosophy, when we discover something is true or right or like something's good, a lot of philosophers often think that that's like what we have to devote our lives to. For Aristotle, it's like, okay, you figured out that like virtue is true. You have to go attain virtue. And so these virtue ethicists are just like, yeah, go do it. If you're like a Kantian and you think the categorical imperative is true, it's like, yeah, you should probably treat other people pretty well for the rest of your life. And you need to be serving others. If you're a utilitarian, it's the same. And so Wolf's point is like, yeah, these are like ethical systems that are true and you should probably live your life by them. But you also have a life. And you like need some fun time in your life too, and you need to enjoy your life. If we discover a task is meaningful, we don't need to devote every single second of our life to that. We need other things too, like we need a job, but we need at least a project that gives our life purpose and meaning, so we have a reason to live. But that's a great point that you raised.
Thanks. Yeah. It's really interesting. Like, do we have to fill our lives with meaningful activities all the time?
It's a really good question. We should talk about that one time. But my criticism of...
As we say in papers, that is beyond the scope of this episode.
Yeah, but we should. That's her most famous argument, too. Hmm. Moral Saints. Hmm. It's great. Hmm. Life-changing piece. Anyway, so my problem with Wolfe, though, is very similar to the one that you raised, Mr. Parsons. It's kind of along this objective line. Like, objective for whom? Or for who? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And my point is not that, like, who says, oh, I can't do some activity. It's more who makes the standard for all people. You know, maybe I don't have the same patience as Taylor does. And I'm just, maybe like knitting is great for Taylor and gives her life a lot of meaning, but it's not going to give my life any meaning, no matter how hard I try. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think Wolfe agrees with, but doesn't address, that there are things that we do not control that change what can give meaning to our lives. And my point here is not like this crocheting thing between Taylor and I. I want to take it to a really far example with someone who has severe disabilities, because I think this is important and often overlooked in philosophy. I raise this question. Let's say that there's a adult, like a 25-year-old adult who has a severe cognitive disability, who might have the same intellectual capabilities as a 1-year-old or 2-year-old or something of this nature. And this person most of the time just sits in a chair and doesn't do very much. But one day their parents gift them a toy, a child's toy. And from the moment it comes in contact with this toy, I don't know what kind of toy it is, whatever, like a musical children's toy. From the day it comes in contact with this toy, it just loves it. You know, it plays with it all the time. It takes care of it. It never wants to leave its side. This seems like a very clear instance to me of an activity that this adult is engaging in that gives its life meaning. Its life, it's, you know, getting up, it's moving around the house. It looks like it's having a great time. Whereas before it was just like sitting in this chair all day. And so it seems like in this instance, this is an example of where something that's very trivial to someone like us, you know, someone who's maybe more cognitively developed, this would not be an activity, I would say, that would give us very much meaning. Mm-hmm. Like hitting one button on a toy that plays the same song over and over every day. I don't think that would give my life meaning. But for this person, it seems like it would. And so I think that's kind of a problem for Wolfe's objective standard, just like you said, Mr. Parsons, because who sets that standard? And so what I want to do here is two things. First, I want to make this standard that Wolfe has relational to someone's character and to their abilities, mostly cognitive, but it can also be physical abilities. Let me give another example for people who don't buy this kind of disabled argument. I think it's very clear that someone's physical or mental abilities dictate what kind of activities they can love. An example that I use is of someone who doesn't have the ability to taste or smell, who goes and wants to be a sommelier or a cheese taster, right? Like, this is just kind of ridiculous to us. But we can imagine someone like this who's cognitively developed but just can't taste or smell. They're missing something. They're missing one of their senses. And so, like, I just don't believe that someone like this could love that activity. And that's fine. But I think what they can love is just based on their abilities. I think the character is an issue too, like the temperament, the virtue is important. But I don't really want to discuss that right here. But I think that's really important in terms of at least your abilities dictating what you can love. And so this is the problem that I'm in. If someone can only love certain things, then that means they can only love certain things, right? Does this make sense what I'm saying? If the wine taster cannot, or if the person who cannot taste cannot love wine tasting, then that means that there's some objective standard to what they can and cannot love. And this is very troubling, I think, for a lot of people, because this changes what we can and cannot love based on who we are as a person. This might be even up to the person. You know, a person just physically might not be able to love someone, another person. But I think it's just clear from activities. There's just things that someone cannot love. And I think this objective standard of love is really scary for a lot of people. So I'm curious about your thoughts on it. Does that scare y'all, first of all? Is that scary?
A little bit. But then I guess the other side of it, it doesn't mean because one person isn't able to love you, that you're unlovable. And so you would think that the way that you are means that there's people out there specifically built to love you and all of your sensibilities. So I think it is scary until you remember that that means that there is something to love you specifically.
Yeah, I get exactly what you're meaning. And something too that I just want to rehash from Wolf, the bar for love is really, really high. The bar for love is like extremely high. So it's not like, you know, if Parsons and I are just completely different temperaments, whatever, we can't be friends. We can't like each other. I'm just following in this Wolf tradition that love is a really, really high bar. It has to engage us in certain ways. Love is a difficult thing to produce, like we were talking about last week, at least personally for me. Like, it's not going to be a 5-month kind of thing where I'm just going to suddenly fall into love. And I think it's the same with an activity too. But yeah, Parsons, what do you think?
Well, the thing that springs to mind for me is this notion of the old saying of, with great power comes great responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of thinking with this, especially the examples you gave, it's like, with greater cognition comes greater responsibility to love the right thing.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Say more.
And I don't know that right is the correct word to use in that instance, because we are talking about abilities and temperament. But, you know, for someone who has an IQ between 90 and 130, you would hope that they would gravitate towards things that are good, good choices for them, and go the opposite direction for things that are bad for them. And you can certainly tie love into that if you're talking about things. I know later in your paper, Andrew, you do bring up some examples of people who might choose to love something that a great many of us might say, like, that is not something good to love. Mm-hmm. Listeners can think of all sorts of horrible examples. And so with that greater cognition, say if someone who has a lower cognition, much lower IQ, 60 or below, we would forgive that easier than someone who is high functioning. Does that make sense? I don't really know where I'm going with that necessarily, but that idea sprung into my head when you were talking about levels of cognition and with the child who has mental disabilities. One of the things I was thinking of, if I could offer this counter, when we were talking about issues of cognition, can a thing that does not understand what love is, can that thing love? So I'm thinking of my wonderful dog, Alfred, who, I mean, obviously loves me, and I can see that in his actions. However, I can imagine that Alfred does not have a conception of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a mental conception of love. And so back to your example of the a mentally disabled child, does that child have the ability to understand what love is, the concept? And if that child does not have, or that adult, I'm sorry, it was an adult, if that adult with mental disability doesn't understand what love is, can we really say that that person loves that child's toy that's been given to them?
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. So I would say that I don't think that something has to understand. I mean, maybe someone Socratic might, but I don't think someone has to understand something in order to exhibit that trait or whatever. Let me give you a good example of that. We said earlier that we hadn't thought much about love before.
Yeah.
We'd maybe thought about it. We've heard it. So we have some like vague concept based on what we've seen, but we've never really thought about it before. Mm-hmm. And so I don't even really know what love is. I don't think maybe based on people's actions. And so I'm not sure if I'd feel comfortable saying that. I've seen this video of someone with Alzheimer's on YouTube who is completely unable to speak, who is completely unable to really do anything. They have more problems. They can move a little bit. They can't really remember anyone, can't remember anything about themselves. They can speak barely. And this person was in front of a piano that they hadn't played for years. And when they sat down, they were able to play this piano. a song that they learned in their youth. And so this example, I think, shows that people, they can, this is kind of, actually I went far off topic, but they can pull something from their very inner part of themselves, even if they can't recognize it and conceptualize it. It's just something that's kind of written on themselves as a human being. And I think love is something like that. Can your dog love you? I don't know if animals can love. Seriously, I don't. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, no.
But a human, I think that humans at least have the capacity of love written on themselves. And it also kind of makes me uncomfortable to say that someone who's severely disabled just doesn't have the ability to love because they can't recognize, they can't conceptualize or say what love is. If you go mute, sorry, you can cut a lot of this, and you can't speak, you have a stroke and you lose the ability to speak, you lose a big part of being able to put the abstract into language. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you lose all the language processing in your head, I think in that instance, you're not going to be able to come up with thoughts, to make thoughts, to put them into the world. But I think you can still love in an acting way and still love. It seemed like that to me. So those are three kind of attempts to answer such an objection.
You know, I'm going to sound really callous. So with your example of the adult with developmental disabilities, you mentioned that it bothers you to say that a human being is not capable of love, although the theory is based on ability. So we might say with the adult with severe mental disabilities, while that adult might enjoy or take pleasure in the child's toy, you might be able to say that pleasure does not equate love.
Yeah.
So how is it that this person...
That's a great question.
Yep. ...loves this toy rather than, you know, just simply takes pleasure in it in some sort of way?
Yep. Great question. So this actually deals a little bit with logic, too. Hmm. So my paper is coming as a supplementation to Wolf's position. And what that means is that I'm holding that my reader will accept Wolf's position as basically true. And so what we can do here is say, if we believe that Wolf's fitting fulfillment view, that to love, to have a meaningful activity in your life, you have to love it. What I say is that if we hold that this activity that this disabled child is engaging in is meaningful to them, then that entails, if we hold Wolf's view, that that love does exist in it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's an entailment. And so we could say that, but then that would mean one of two things. Either that activity actually isn't very meaningful, which I don't buy, just because it seems like it's produced a change in their life, a reason for living, something that's motivated them. Or we can say that Wolf's position is wrong, that some activities that we engage in that are meaningful do not include love. And so we can hold one or the other, but we can't hold both.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? That's a fantastic question,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a really great question. What was I going to say? Brush up on your logic, not at you, but that's why it's important to have some, that's a really valid criticism, actually. And I think that goes into Wolf's position too. And so I can use Wolf as a cop out because of some finicky logic in my paper. let's talk about one last thing that I think is really interesting for us. So,
well, hang on. Sorry,
no,
I interrupt
please.
You again. Taylor, you have any thoughts at this point? I don't want to box you out.
Not that I think I can put into words. Mm-hmm. I'm just contemplating just right now.
Feel
trying
free
to figure out what I think.
Anything. It's not going to hurt my feelings. I've heard a lot, so I love to hear it. I think there's two things here, okay, that people can say. I think one of them is this kind of broad, this one's probably going to annoy a lot of people, I think. Actually, I'll just move on to the last one. I still think this one will annoy a lot of people, my response. We were talking a little bit about earlier about how someone can love doing bad things. And this is a really great point that you raised, because it would seem like some people's capacities, their capabilities, and their character move them to enjoy doing bad things. I can think of like a serial killer or someone who has a serious psychopathic or sociopathic disability. And those certain situations, we can see like someone getting great pleasure at least out of doing really bad things. I'm not big into the serial killer stuff. I know some people are, so forgive me if I mess something up. But we can see like some serial killers getting a jolt out of killing people. Like that's their meaningful project mm-hmm. that they're engaged in. They like sending notes to the police. They don't really kill these people because they have anything like inherently wrong with that person, or they don't have any bad feelings towards them in particular. They just enjoy the activity. They like hiding from the cops and stuffing bodies where they can't be found. Like, they genuinely enjoy that. And some might even say that's a meaningful activity for them. So if that's true, if that is a meaningful activity, and I think in some cases it plausibly could, because we see these like super depressed people going in and doing it and then they're happy or whatever, I could see someone saying that that gives meaning to their life. And like we're saying, if an activity gives meaning to your life, that means you must love it. So does that mean that it's possible for us to love doing bad, to doing harm? Because we don't usually think about that, I think, if this is possible. So I love doing these questions about love's properties. Mm-hmm. So I pose this to both of you. Do you think we can love doing bad things? It's a tough question, but what's the gut?
I want to say no, but I don't know if that's because that's what I think or that's what I want to be true, that I don't want it to be possible for people to love causing harm to other people rather than just deriving pleasure from it. But your example of the serial killer made me think of the show Dexter,
yeah,
where the main character is a serial killer, but he only kills other serial killers or people of the sort that have been causing a large mm-hmm. degree of harm to the general population. And he doesn't love it, but he does derive pleasure from it. It amounts in a net good. So it also makes me wonder, where does that fit in? If he is doing something that we would say is objectively bad because he's killing people, but he's causing a net good by eliminating serial killers that are killing other people, where does that fit in with the meaning that it creates in his life?
Yeah, that's like an ethical question, and it's a great one.
Yeah, very utilitarian of you.
Yeah, it is. I think
that whole net good.
I think he's still doing a bad action. Let me give y'all another one though that I think might be better. This is based off of the mm-hmm. TV show Better Call sure. Saul, for people who are familiar with it. There's two characters in it. The main character, Jimmy McGill, and his girlfriend, eventually wife, named Kim Wexler. And Jimmy and Kim love scamming people. Mm-hmm. They scam grandmas and grandpas out of their insurance money. They put up pranks on like businessmen. They say that they have like a huge pension to invest and get the businessmen who do investments to like buy their dinner or buy their meal, and then they leave and whatever. And they end up scamming this guy on the show who is actually a pretty likable guy because they just enjoy it. And when they try to stop doing it, they just can't. And they're drawn back into scamming and scamming and scamming. And so this is like a certain situation that I think is some people can relate to. We see it on TV. I think some people just like doing these like small little wrongs, but it still seems like a bad action. It seems like, I know neither of you are familiar with the show, but it seems like in both cases it adds meaning to their life. And yeah, I think it clearly adds meaning to their life in the show, and it's bad. And so that's another example. We can also think about like a mob kind of show where the characters are like killing and having a good time, gambling, whatever. So I think there's these situations. Mr. Parsons, you're rubbing your chin like a philosopher. So what are you thinking?
I need my pipe so I can gesticulate with it.
The pipe?
And like tap it on my teeth as I'm thinking. Well, you asked for our gut, and my gut reaction is that no, this is not love, and it's not meaningful, not objectively meaningful, any of these things we've talked about. And I've not thought this through deeply. I mean, this is just right here, right now. But Taylor mentioned with Dexter, he receives a jolt mm-hmm. when he does this. And mm-hmm. Andrew, with your example, your scheming friends from Better Call Saul receive. You said they love scamming people.
Yeah.
I would be interested from a biological perspective of what happens in a person's brain when they are participating in activity that is pleasurable versus engaging with a person that they love, or engaging in activity with that person that they love. I'm curious what the difference of that would be. And I want to reference back to Plato when I say pleasure. If we think of the tripartite soul and the bottom layer is urges and the middle layer is emotion, and of course, and the top being reason for those who are unfamiliar, the urges is like that pleasure, right? And maybe even the emotion, but I really more so think of pleasure as being the part of us that is an urge that we don't rationally think about. I'd be curious, chemically speaking, what happens in a person's brain between something we might call a pleasure, like gambling or sex or drinking or murdering or whatever, versus engaging in an activity with someone that you feel great love for, and you're doing something that you both love together. I wonder if there's a difference there chemically. And that brings me, I guess, to my kind of second point when I get to my more objective argument about this. Pleasure and love are not the same thing. Now, pleasure can be included in an activity that is love, but there are pleasures that are objectively not good.
Yep.
And even though that pleasure, like say if we go back to Dexter, might result in a net good, that doesn't mean it's love, right? And even though Dexter receives pleasure from that, it also doesn't mean that it's love. Now, it might be love for him, but I don't think objectively that it is. I feel there's a difference between, and I haven't worked this out totally in my head, but I feel there's a difference between what we might call pleasure and what we might call love, even though there's some connection there between the two.
I think both of you in this have an entailment upon love that incorporates some amount of goodness in it. And I think that's very fair to think about. This is like something that's just kind of, it's an underpinning of a lot of Western philosophy and a lot of Western religious philosophy too. Love is wanting the good of the other, right? That's like a classic mm-hmm. definition. And that entails that if you love something, it's good. So an evil act necessarily can't be love. I think that's one possible answer. I think another possible answer is just saying like, yeah, they just have a bad character. They have like, they just have a bad character. What you can love depends on your character and abilities. People who have bad characters will love bad things. And that doesn't make it right. That just means that they have a bad character.
Can that person who has a bad character, can they improve their character and become someone who does meaningful activities? In your definition, with ability and character, can that change?
Well, I think it depends where it is on that line. I think it might be a spectrum between character and ability, because certainly ability does dictate what our character is like, right? Like, yeah. But I'm assuming, like, if we think that character is something made up of vice and virtue, doing vicious acts makes our character worse, doing virtuous acts makes our character better. I'm sure if someone wanted to improve their character and was engaged in virtuous actions, I'm assuming it could be better. I'm just assuming, like, I just can imagine, like, a lot of these mafia and gang shows where like this young kid will come in, start stealing from the sidewalk guy, you know, stealing some of his money, and then going up and stealing like from a house, and then going up and stealing from the bank, and then killing someone, right? Like that's the typical street life in the TV shows where his character is getting worse and worse and worse. And so I could plausibly see it as them improving it and loving something better, but that still means that, like, based on their character in that moment, they can love something bad.
Yeah, that's all very interesting.
I was going to add on to what you said, that in the Aristotelian conception of virtue, when you're habituating the soul to desire good things, I think it would be possible to, as you're becoming more virtuous and making a habit of doing and pursuing good things, that you would also be able to love better and better things.
And that's interesting too, which I don't talk about and we don't talk about, but you raise a really great point, Taylor. Can we love in degrees? Or is love something that is in degrees? Mm-hmm. And that's something we talked a little bit about with Plato and Aristotle. Mm-hmm. I personally think that it might be degreed upon yourself in relation to yourself. Because I don't want to say, if I think that a severely disabled person, for example, I don't want to say that I can love more than them. I don't think that's right. I just think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I think how much we love is just in relation to ourselves, in relationship to our potential.
Okay.
I don't know what y'all think about that, but that just seems right to me.
I mean, it rings true with me. Yeah. Yeah. If I'm going to be the critical guy, I'll go back to that argument of conception of love. Is love something that really just exists outside of concept, or is love just strictly a concept?
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
But I mean, you know, what you say rings true to me, my gut reaction.
And I mean, if love is like not some objective criteria in the universe, like a form or something, then that would seem to me, it would even be more true that it's just dependent on yourself. I don't know if that's how it rings for y'all. If love is just within us and it's not like some real concept, then it's like, well, how am I going to measure this just concept that I hold in my brain against someone else's? If there's no standard, it's just really relative to myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do y'all think?
Yeah.
We can close out on this, or no thoughts too. I've been thinking about this stuff for a while, so I feel bad. No. I'm just like, oh, yeah, what do you think about this?
It's interesting to think about people loving, I guess, more or more deeply than other people, dependent on their self.
Yeah.
But I guess that also kind of rings true for me, that I tend to feel like I love a lot. And that's just kind of how I am as a person, that I have a lot of love and I enjoy loving people, just in whatever way that means. Which I guess would mean that there are some people that just don't love that much, which is a hard thing to grapple with when you are on the side of more.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
To conceptualize that some people just don't for any reason or none in particular.
I don't. Go ahead.
And, you know, can love be like naivety for the person who just loves everything? Is that love genuine in all cases? Yeah, is there some naivety there?
That's a great point.
I mean, yeah.
I don't like, this is something that we didn't talk about and I don't want to talk about a lot, but I think that a lot of people who say they love a lot of things don't actually love them. I think love is something really hard, like we kind of talked about, and to love a lot without a lot of practice or whatever, I don't know, without doing a lot of soul searching and forming deep relationships with that thing, I just think is impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it can become a metaphor. There's certainly nothing wrong with saying, like, I incredibly enjoy this activity, you know, versus saying I love this activity or something.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, like, the word love becomes a replacement for that, for the person that says they love all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's nothing wrong with that necessarily.
There's nothing wrong
with
saying
person isn't meaning to be disingenuous or to deceive you or anything like that. They're just expressing that this thing that they care quite a lot about, they call love, when it's just something that they care a great deal about. And again, there's nothing wrong with that.
I agree. I think that there's nothing wrong with that from like a linguistic or sociological standpoint, where we just say these words that we don't actually mean. But I think if we think about them more, you know, fully, that's a problem. If we're trying to categorize things that we love and we think we love all these things, like, that just seems wrong. I keep thinking, now that you mentioned that, about someone who's kind of a jack of all trades and who has a bunch of hobbies that they love, but they aren't really good at any of them. Somebody who does yo-yo tricks and, I don't know, learns languages and, I don't know, there's only so much you can do and be really detailed in, you know what I mean? And spend a time developing a relationship with. And it's important, you know, if we hold that meaning comes from love, loving an activity, and that loving is very difficult, then we need to think about necessarily what love is so we can form more meaning in our lives. Like, this is really important if we hold that to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. From a qualification standpoint, yeah, it's problematic. Although, you know, Wittgenstein would say meaning is in the use of a word. You know, if you say, I love Swansea AFC, if you get what I'm saying, then you get what I'm saying. But yes, for my categorization aspect, sure, in a properties aspect, sure. I think also, too, when you say, like, love is difficult, here's the deal. I love the both of you. And I don't mean that in a, I feel really strongly about you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I truly do. Mm-hmm. But loving both of you is not difficult. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. There's no strife. There's no striving.
Let me push back.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
it's not difficult now, but it took a lot to develop our relationship, right?
Oh, for sure. For yeah. sure.
So I don't know if mm-hmm. the act of loving is difficult, but I think the act of developing love, mm-hmm. a loving relationship, is extremely difficult. What do you think about this?
I like that caveat because it kind of creates a balance between I can love my best friend and it's not difficult, but if she hurts my feelings, to keep loving her and not just say, okay, she hurt my feelings, we're not friends anymore, can be difficult because you have to resolve the problem within yourself and with the other person. Mm. And it could be difficult to bring those feelings up or to apologize and admit that you're wrong. So in that way, to develop a relationship that's strong enough to say that I love this person is difficult mm-hmm. because it requires difficult things yeah. of us.
Right. And when I said that, you know, that loving you two is very easy, or rather not difficult, you know, that's because, to my knowledge anyway, we've never had a falling out of any kind. Yeah. And that would make it difficult. I think mm-hmm. what Andrew's saying
yeah.
in difficult, now we're talking about meaning of a word, is that, of course, the relationship that the three of us have has taken a great deal of time to develop to the point that where it is. But that development yep. wasn't difficult. It just took time. And so we're saying the time is what's difficult.
Mm-hmm. I think time, it also took effort, right? Like to get to know each other, a lot of mm-hmm. effort. Mm-hmm. It also took-
That's true.
It also mm-hmm. took something in our past. This is going to be super meta. Something mm-hmm. in our past disposed us to like each other enough to want to get to know each other better. And mm-hmm. so that's kind of wild too. Like we mm-hmm. all had to have something that made us interested in philosophy. And so that's mm-hmm. really, when you put all of these permutations together, it's like, wow, you know, that's mm-hmm. wild. Mm-hmm. I think about this a lot. For someone who's like in a, so let's say like a college relationship, because this is how this whole paper started. Think about like mm-hmm. the chances of that ending up the way it was. You meeting this random person from a place way across the country who luckily got placed into a place where you are engaging basically on a similar schedule in the same general location. And then on top of that, you have to put in time enough to get to know the other person and blah, 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 blah. That's a lot, right? That's a lot. Mm-hmm. But in the same way too, and I'm sorry for keeping this, I'm thinking of parents who have their kids. From the moment they're born, mm-hmm. they're just, I love them so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like yeah. a dad too. Yeah. A dad saying that, like, I can get why the mom will say that because they've been through like a traumatic experience. But the dad, pretty wild.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
That might be a counterpoint to me.
Yeah. God, we got to wrap this up. I will yeah. say as a father that I actually really thought about that when my kids were born. Of course, I love them, but I didn't mm-hmm. certainly have the same connection that their mother did. And I do think there's definitely something to saying that like degrees of love for a person just takes time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there is that sort of primal love that you have for a newborn that might be different than, say, a friendship love that's developed over time. Mm-hmm. I've often told people when I think about friendships, as I tell them, and when I say this, I mean, I'm usually talking about people about your age who begin to drift apart from people they knew in high school.
Yep.
It's that friendships take work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you can't set a person on the shelf mm-hmm. for 3 years and then expect everything to be the same. And when I say work, mm-hmm. I don't mean like it's necessarily hard, but you have to set aside time. You have to talk with them. Mm-hmm. You have to text with them. You have to get coffee every now and then. You have to maintain yeah. these relationships. It's mm-hmm. maintenance. And I hope that doesn't take the romanticism mm-hmm. out of loving yeah. friendships.
It's true.
They can't be neglected and expect it to be a wonderful mm-hmm. friendship the way that it was how many ever years ago. There is mm-hmm. definitely something to the concept of time spent together in whatever way.
Yeah, I think that's great. Let's quickly wrap this kind of two-part oh, yeah. episode.
We're setting a record series here. Up.
Mm-hmm. yeah. Let me just close us out on this kind of series that we did. So we discussed love generally, different people's thoughts about it, and some complicated questions. I would say that's a pretty good summary of what we've done. What is like the one key takeaway that you all have taken from this kind of series on love?
I think I would say that love requires more thought than we're inclined to give it. That it shouldn't be as passive as it is in our lives, and that we should prioritize not just romantic love, but all the other types of love as well, because it's so enriching to our lives, and not just let those things fade away because we think it's supposed to be easy, instead of realizing that love is a choice that we make to commit to another person.
Great.
That's really wonderful, Taylor.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think I agree with you. We don't pay attention enough to love. Not like it doesn't get its due, if you will. We kind of take it for granted. And to think about it helps us really sort of qualify why it is we love others or love particular activities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. Another thing that one of my takeaways was when we were talking about last week, or rather last episode, with Nozick and his notion of two people becoming one. I think that's a lot of our popular culture, you know, we talk about two people becoming one and, you know, rom-coms or whatever, but you can go all the way back to ancient Greece and the Symposium. We're talking about two people that were torn apart by the gods and have to find each other, mm-hmm. you know, yep. the soulmates. No matter how it comes about, when we love someone and that person is no longer a part of our life, whether that's by a death or just a broken friendship or relationship, we are hurt by that. We are less because of that. And it takes time for us to recover from that, because my kind of epiphany was how last episode of how much that has to do with our identity. Because we are that person, and that friendship or whatever is kind of a unit. And yep. when that unit comes apart for whatever reason, that's harmful and hurtful, because it impacts mm-hmm. our identity. And so in many ways, I guess we could say that what we love is in many ways kind of who we are.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Andrew? I mean, I know you've thought about this a whole lot, your paper, but, you know, we've had these discussions the last two episodes. I don't know, anything for you?
Well, I think this is kind of dumb, I think, but what I just realize more and more as I think about this and talk about this and read about this is that love is just so much more complicated than I thought, or maybe it's not. Yeah. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's. I think it's really interesting that it's just something we feel, and it's not complicated to us. And mm-hmm. it's complicated to think about, but it's so complex. And I think that means that there's mm-hmm. real fruit in thinking about something like this. Let me give you a quick example. Mm-hmm. The human heart is one of the most complex organs. I might be getting yelled at by someone, but it's like one of the most complex organs in the human body. But we don't even think about this. We don't think about breathing. Yeah. It's something just natural to us. And I think in cases where love is something that, or an instance where we say we love something and we actually don't, or whatever, it's those instances aside, we've all felt love without thinking about it. And it's not complicated mm-hmm. in those situations, but it is something complicated to think about. And I think that means it's worth thinking about. So I'm super glad we were able to talk about this. Thank y'all.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been great.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. We love that you listened to this episode and the previous episode on love. We hope you really enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. I think the three of us certainly did. We would love to hear what you think about all the stuff that we've talked about. So please hit us up on all these places Taylor's getting ready to tell you about.
If you want to let us know how much you loved this episode or what things you love, let us know on Instagram at Open Door Philosophy or on our YouTube channel in the comments section, because Andrew checks them all. So if you leave us a comment, he will see it.
Yeah, I was just about to check. Thank y'all all so much for listening. We really, really appreciate it. And remember, when your life is in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. Thank you.
All right, see ya.
Peace.
Bye, guys.